that's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse.
Welcome to Nature Bets Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.fm. This July 2nd, 29 edition, episode 128 of Nature Bets Last, comes to you live from Rakino Island in Aotearoa, New Zealand, from Winchester County, New York, in the United States. This is Kevin Hester, and I'm again joined by my co-host, Professor Guy McPherson. Today's show includes a conversation with Rory Virato, who invited Guy to testify before the New York Council's Committee on Environmental Protection. A day after Guy and others testified, New York City declared a climate emergency. Congratulations. Guy, will you do the honors, please?
Thank you, Kevin. Rory Virato is a founding member of Extinction Rebellion New York City. He is also a PhD student and research assistant in the Philosophy and Education Department at Columbia University. There's more. He is also graduate coordinator for the Freedom and Citizenship Program in the Center for American Studies at Columbia University. And there's even more. Rory is also adjunct professor of philosophy at Fordham University. Rory, welcome to Nature Bets Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We will be taking your toll-free calls today. Please give us a few minutes to spend time with our guest and then give us a call with your questions and comments. We are most easily reached with a toll-free telephone call to 888-874-4888.
Well, firstly, Rory, I'd like to congratulate you on the success that you and all the other XR people in New York had with getting the motion passed. First question I'd like to ask you is, what was the response from the people in XR when you proposed that Guy present on your behalf?
Great question. I acted semi-independently in accordance with the principles of Extinction Rebellion. It's highly decentralized, and as long as members of XR with knowledge and sincerity act in accordance with our principles, then we can do essentially whatever we like to advance the cause. And I have been familiar with Guy's work for some time. I know that he was a signatory to, I think, the second open letter from Extinction Rebellion that was issued in The Guardian. And so I reached out to him in the hopes that he would lend his expertise to help us get this declaration passed, and I was glad that he did so. So there were really no negative or positive reactions from XR internally, other than they were happy and pleased that Guy participated and testified.
Go ahead, Kevin.
That's wonderful that it was received, because so often when Guy speaks and when I speak in the same light, there's an enormous amount of pushback from people. So that's a great an outcome. So where do we go from here? Where does the New York XR people and the New York Environmental Committee go? Now that they've declared an emergency, what are they going to do?
That's the million-dollar question, you know, and that was one of our problems with the wording of the legislation itself, is that although it does a good job, I think, of sort of acknowledging empirical reality related to climate breakdown and other ecological crises, it offers virtually nothing in terms of concrete or practical actions to be taken, policy measures to be implemented, etc. So hopefully, my personal hope, and I think XR New York's hope, is that this will reorient the committee and the council and all New York City lawmakers in general towards future legislation that will hopefully have immediate concrete application. As for now, we're still awaiting that, unfortunately.
Rory, when you testified, you used a metaphor, and I'd like you to describe that metaphor for our audience.
Absolutely. I chose the metaphor of a ship, and I think that this is important for a variety of reasons, and I broke it into three parts in my testimony. And the first part was pertaining to Buckminster Fuller's idea of spaceship Earth, right? This was popularized in, I think, a book that he wrote in the 1960s, and it's just the notion that the Earth itself as a planet can be thought of essentially as a gigantic spaceship on which all humans live and dwell. And Fuller emphasized, you know, that all members of Spaceship Earth are crew, not just passengers, meaning that we all have certain duties that we must undertake for the care and maintenance of our shared living space. And I like that metaphor for a variety of reasons, one of which is because it helps to shrink the global community, kind of in the way that I think Marshall McLuhan was getting at when he talked about the global village. And this has been helped, I believe, with the advent of mass communication and especially the internet, the shrinking of the world in that way. And the idea is that, you know, a different type of consciousness might emerge from this, one that's based on more humanistic principles, that's sort of post-racial, post-nationalist, etc. And so that's one element of the ship metaphor. The second that I discussed was Plato's ship of state analogy. And this comes from his Republic, I think, book 4, if I'm recalling correctly. And this is a metaphor that Plato uses to describe political communities of any kind. He's talking about the state, but we can think of it as applying to cities or even the planet. And the notion here is that the ship of state is filled with folks, crew members, who are preoccupied with their sort of mundane duties related to keeping the ship in operation, right? So cleaning the deck or whatever it may be. And everybody is performing their own role, hopefully with excellence, but they're also competing amongst each other and sort of vying for the ability to move up in the hierarchy. They're not so much concerned with the health of the ship as a whole as they are with their own well-being and career advancement, whatever, if we want to stretch the metaphor a little bit. But Plato tells us that there's at least one person on the ship who seems useless to these crew members, but who is in fact the most important and also most fit to run the ship. And this is the navigator, this is the stargazer, the person who does not perform any duties that seem immediately related to the maintenance of the ship, but because of his or her special skills and knowledge related to navigation, he or she is indispensable, actually, to the ship's operation and health, because the navigator knows where the ship has been, where it is now, and perhaps most importantly, where it's headed and how best to get there, which may or may not be, you know, a straight line. It may require a very seemingly incorrect path to arrive at the appropriate destination. So that's the ship of state, which I think is timeless and meaningful for all persons in positions of power to ponder. The third metaphor that I discussed was really just imagining being on a ship, on a vessel, maybe the Titanic, if that's the simplest thing to think about, and just the very real and embodied experience of being on a ship that is sinking, that not one that is about to sink or that might sink, you know, that's headed for a field of icebergs, but one that in fact has struck the iceberg, so to speak, and is presently sinking, or maybe we can go so far as to say sunk. And it's at that point that we have to change virtually everything related to our behavior, our ethics, our view of the world, because no longer do we have a ship that can take us anywhere. We don't have a ship at all. We're clinging to driftwood, right? And so our calculations change across the board. And I reference this line from Thoreau that I like in this context from his Civil Disobedience, and see if I can remember it. Something to the effect of, if I have unjustly wrested a plank from a drowning man, I must restore it to him, though I drown myself. He says this would be inconvenient, but a man who would save himself in such a case has lost himself. And that, for me, is sort of the fundamental approach that we ought to be taking towards our ethical behavior at this point in the Anthropocene. And there's a whole sort of school of philosophical thought called lifeboat ethics that contemplates this kind of situation.
Yeah, you know,
that answer is absolutely tailor-made for me. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but I used to be an ocean sailor. I've done 16 ocean passages on small yachts.
Wow.
I've spent a lot of time wondering about what it would be like to put out a mayday when my boat was sinking. I was on a boat once where we had to put out a mayday where we'd hit the rocks, but we were safe and we weren't sinking and help was nearby, whereas with this mayday, no one's coming to the rescue. So in a segue from those wonderful comments that you've made, I'd like to ask your opinion on an expression I heard in Dell recently. And the quote was, getting busy with action can be a distraction from full acceptance of our predicament.
Mm. Yes. I like that phrasing, and I tend to agree. I mean, for many reasons, one of which is that I think contemplation, philosophical inquiry of that sort is, systematically purged under global neoliberal capitalism, especially as it exists in the United States. You can't monetize contemplation, right? And so people don't have the opportunity to engage in it, and they also lack the skill set to do so. Oftentimes because they've been miseducated deliberately, I would say. You know, the Texas School Board of Education a few years ago in their platform specifically forbade the teaching of critical thinking in Texas public schools, for example. But then more broadly, and I think probably both of you view our situation similarly, is through sort of the lens of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Stages of Grief, right? Which are just a heuristic, you know, they don't have to be perfect. But the idea that you could get caught up in action, for me, I think connects well with a form of denial, right? So I just encountered this in a kind of disheartening way. This past weekend, I was at Left Forum in Brooklyn, which is sort of the, I think, in the United States' largest socialist conference for activists annually. It's been going on for some time, 40 years, I think. And I was at a panel called something like International Efforts to Save the Planet. And I self-identified at one point, you know, as a founding member of Extinction Rebellion New York, etc. And folks from the Sunrise Movement were there and other various movements, and they were very resistant to my framing, and I even used some of Guy's language about conceptualizing the Earth as being in hospice care and things like this. And almost to a person, I was met with accusations of fatalism and, you know, resignation and these types of things. And it was disheartening and dispiriting. But at the same time, there was a very small group, maybe two or three folks, who piped up later after I had sort of already taken the bullets, so to speak, from most of the other folks in attendance and agreed. And we had a very interesting discussion about the kinds of things that I was just saying, how your entire worldview ought to change to reflect the empirical reality of the situation as you understand it. And so maybe there is some hope, but I do agree with the sentiment that action can be a distraction, especially if it's bound up with the sort of level of consciousness or worldview that produced our problems in the first place. We have to move to a different world space.
You know, I'm curious about the Left Forum. Did anybody propose any actions?
The Green New Deal was bandied about. That was talked about the most, I think. And there was a gentleman, I'm not sure which organization he was with, but he was a little bit older, and he had some significant experience with organizing. And he spoke more broadly about creating sort of intentional communities with direct deliberative democratic practices and things like that, which I'm definitely sympathetic to, and I think that that's something that people should pursue. But other than that, nothing that impressed me too much.
Well, I can't say I'm terribly surprised. I suspect that Thoreau was influenced by Plato's Republic. Mm-hmm. For our listeners who don't know, it was in the Republic that it was basically Plato's philosophical manifesto. And he explained most of his famous and history-altering concepts about justice, truth, government, and the nature of reality. So it's quite a manifesto. I have no doubt that Gerhard Hardin, the ecologist who was at the University of California system as a professor for many years, was influenced by both of those individuals when he wrote his essay in Science, Living on a Lifeboat. And you brought up lifeboat ethics. It seems there's a thread here that goes all the way back to Plato, through Thoreau, through ecologists in the 1960s and 1970s. So let's assume we have a bunch of people willing to give up their plank. They're floating. The lifeboat has broken up. They've stolen their plank from somebody else, say, in third world country. At this point, what do we do? What specifically, pragmatically, does the plank look like, and how do we hand it over? How do we give up our privilege, and what does that really mean to people that we have essentially destroyed their societies and stolen their planks from them long ago?
That's an excellent question, and I think about that in many different ways. I think, first of all, we should recognize that it's not a unitary plank, right? There are many planks, and they're going to differ in size, you know, for people from the United States versus people from the global south or something. But in general, one of the most significant ways that I think about it is intergenerationally. Right, so the old and the young. I find it very intriguing and overwhelming and perplexing that the youth are being placed into a position, an existential position, that typically is thought of as corresponding only to old age, which is to say that they have to confront their own mortality in their youth, which is supposed to be the time when you think you're invincible and you'll never die and blah, blah, blah. So that's one way that I think about it. The plank represents what the older generations have done and are still doing and are still holding on to at the, you know, really the very real mortal expense of their own progeny. The continuation of their own species, and not just their own species, but all of life on Earth. And for me, this also connects, you know, one of the texts that really took me down this path. I had studied history and political theory for the most part, and with a leftist bent, and also an interest in developmental psychology because my advisor was a developmental psychologist in addition to a political theorist. But I read a book called Overshoot, The Ecological Basis of Revolutionary Change by William Catton a few years ago, and that sort of set me down this more ecologically informed path. And in that book, he also emphasizes the generational distinctions. And so I think that looks like older folks giving things up and being willing to completely transform their ways of life fundamentally. But also, you know, in my more extreme moments, I think, or my more sci-fi fantasy moments, whatever, I think about what it might mean to consider the deliberate reduction of human population as a form of triage in the face of die-off that often accompanies the ecological phenomenon of overshoot. In other words, might it be better for us to think about mass suicide almost as an attempt to stave off the natural deaths of exponentially more people? You know, that's just an aside that I think about sometimes.
Yeah, I think about the deaths of a lot of people a lot of the time, but I don't think this is a forum for naming names.
Yeah. Well, but as Utah Phillips said, right, the planet is not dying, it's being killed, and the people who are killing it have names and addresses.
Right. Yes. And in that light, it's just reported today that June was the hottest month in recorded history here on Earth. That's from the Copernicus Climate Change Service, so a reliable source. And one could argue that we have already killed the planet, that we have achieved functional extinction given the magnitude of the aerosol masking effect or global dimming. So if the murder has already been done, and it appears that we're all in the same jail cell at this point, now what?
Yeah, You can tease that out to almost any timeline. You know, like, when was the inertia baked into human evolution that led us to this point? Certainly the Industrial Revolution, right? Perhaps the dawn of agriculture, perhaps bipedalism in general.
Certainly harnessing fire, harnessing the electron, the atom.
Yeah, yes.
It looks like there were a few hundreds wrong turns we took along the way, and most of those people are already 6 feet under. So we can't really do much about that. And on the other hand, I'm a huge fan of justice, even though it's starting to sound like I'm one of those older people who screwed the planet. So
to an extent, we are blameless insofar as we're all thrown existentially into a world that we didn't choose. We didn't choose to be born. We didn't choose the parameters of the world into which we are born. And so what matters is the exercise of our agency once we're here and once we learn, you know, about our capacities and the situation that we're in. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a novel problem in the history of the species. And I am also, you know, I'm a philosophical absurdist. And I think if you are an absurdist, the root of your absurdism lies in humans' consistency in overestimating their own capabilities. In other words, we've created a problem. We didn't intend to create it. We're definitely not capable of solving it. So I don't know what the hell's going to happen.
Well, that's right. And I struggle similarly with the idea of pursuing justice and recognizing that blaming and shaming at this point are pretty senseless. So where does that leave us? I mean, I think there's a lot of people who have done some horrible things and continue to do horrible things, even in my name, as a member of this country.
Yes.
And I don't want that to continue, but we're in this horrific existential state, in light of global dimming, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Who do we blame besides ourselves? And blaming ourselves doesn't do anything except, you know, depress us, and I'm no fan of that. So philosophically, this is a wonderful time to be pursuing philosophy.
Yes. Yes, I tend to agree. Socrates says in the Phaedo that philosophy is about dying in preparation for being dead. That's the purpose of philosophy. And I agree with that. And of course, that's reiterated in the 20th century or 19th century and beyond with existentialism, which I consider myself to be. But at the same time, I think that more people than ever are fundamentally ill-equipped for philosophizing. Not just because of the miseducation that I described earlier, but also because of our just broader culture and the media environment, the distractions that Kevin mentioned, all of these things just militate against philosophizing. And so I don't know. I'm of the opinion that many millions, perhaps billions, will simply be completely taken by surprise. They already are, through localized events. And as those increase in frequency and intensity, more and more folks will just be devastated without the luxury of philosophical reflection about why. And I lament that.
Yeah, and you know, that's an important motivator for my work, and I suspect Kevin's as well, is to inform people of what lies ahead, that every individual dies, a concept we seem to have great difficulty with in so-called Western culture. The notion that all species go extinct, these are not concepts that we embrace throughout our lives. In fact, in the United States and Western Europe, as nearly as I can tell, we avoid thinking about death. We avoid thinking about dying and grief and grieving and bodily functions and basically every important thing that we do throughout our lives, we don't pay much attention to. And so where does that leave us as educators? You know, you teach philosophy at Fordham University. You're interested, obviously, in climate change and abrupt climate change. How do you connect those two topics in your classrooms?
Yes, this is something that I've been thinking about more systematically, because I think it's urgent that we all, those of us who are able, do precisely that. And I think, you know, there's several different ways of looking at it. It's very contextual. But in general, I think I agree with you about the West's unwillingness to confront mortality. And I would broaden that. Although I do think there are some Eastern traditions that are more open to impermanence, right? That's the whole root of Buddhism. But at the same time, I agree with the work that has been done by a social psychologist named Sheldon Solomon, who has built on Ernest Becker's work from the 1970s, famous book Denial of Death, if you've ever heard of that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great one. And so he has a whole theory, terror management theory, Solomon does, that posits essentially exactly what you were saying, that all culture, all human activity, even procreation, is essentially what he calls immortality projects, right? So religions, of course, are an example of this. Anything that we can use to convince ourselves, first, that we're part of something bigger, and therefore, secondly, when we die, we actually get to continue through our lineage, through our patriotism, etc. And so in terms of education, I guess for me, I try to address both those streams, both our mortality and the ways in which we distract ourselves from our mortality. And I think the first is can be sort of answered through existentialism, right? The deep thoughts about mortality from folks like Nietzsche or Viktor Frankl, whom you referenced in your testimony. I assign his work frequently. Kierkegaard, all of the great existentialists, Camus, especially his myth of Sisyphus. And then at the same time, often through the same works, but also other philosophical works, including especially Plato's, the pursuit of critical thinking. And the application of that critical thinking not only outward towards the culture, but inward towards oneself, towards one's inherited values and beliefs, ways of being. And so this, for me, goes back exactly to what Socrates says in Plato's Phaedo about preparation for death. This is how we should educate humans always, whether we're under the shadow of extinction or not. It just so happens that at this moment in the Anthropocene, and you know, I'm not one to say that we're all going to go extinct tomorrow, but I do think that the timeline is terrifying and relevant to our lifetimes. But the point being that we are all now placed in this position where we ought to be learning how to accept death and confront it head on.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. On social media recently, somebody accused me of routinely claiming we will be extinct by next Tuesday. So I like that you don't think we're going extinct tomorrow.
No, yeah.
Next Tuesday is a full week away.
Yeah, that's plenty of time.
So that takes me to another question, another level maybe, a step further. So you describe how you connect climate change and in teaching philosophy. Mm-hmm. How do you also create links between XR, your classroom teaching, and your own personal philosophy, the way you live? Is there any difference between that and what you teach in the classrooms? Can you flesh that out a little bit for us?
Sure. Yeah, there's much to be said about this. And sort of, I don't know, I haven't yet, this is just occurring to me in response to your question, but I haven't yet incorporated any texts in my syllabi that explicitly address climate change, partially because there's a dearth of quality texts of that kind, at least ones that undergrads would find interesting. And so that's something I'm working on. But to the broader question, I think that any existentialist worth his or her salt agrees that that your personal philosophy must be embodied and actualized. So it's not enough just to write about it. You have to actually engage in activities that correspond to your beliefs, or else you're essentially a hypocrite or maybe lazy at best. And so for me, that's part of my work with XR. I would be inauthentic, which is the worst sin imaginable for an existentialist, if I didn't engage in some practical social political activity to promote my beliefs. And so XR operates that way for me on a personal level, but also what attracted me to XR from the start was, first of all, its intellectual basis, thanks to the open letters signed by yourself and many others I admire, including especially Noam Chomsky, but also its commitment from the get-go to civil disobedience. Civil disobedience, especially in the United States, I think, is very powerful, or historically has been quite powerful. And it's powerful because it's a form of communication. It's not just about breaking the law because the law is unjust. Yes, that's the motivation. But the mechanism for change, in my view, is the way that civil disobedience communicates to low information folks, people who just aren't paying attention or whatever, and also people who hold opposing views, that, you know, something is horribly awry here and that we need to look at things in a different light. And so civil disobedience is a transformational tool, I think, in political life. And it's one that's easily accessible to any citizen who is willing and able to risk arrest. And I think, that myself personally as a white man at an elite academic institution, I also have a certain amount of privilege, and that privilege should be put to use. I can get arrested without as much fear of being shot, for example, as a poor black person in America. And so putting our bodies on the line is important as well.
Yeah, that's great. And
Rory, in New Zealand 3 decades ago, we blockaded our harbors against nuclear powered and armed ships coming in, and we got arrested with direct action, and we stopped those ships coming, and we had the government change the legislation to make it illegal. I am a firm believer and a big supporter of direct action to bring about political change.
Yes, that's excellent. I'm glad you got those results. I believe in it as well.
And I'd like to go down one more little part of the philosophical road that we've been talking about, and an accusation that gets leveled against myself and Guy regularly about taking away hope from people with our prognosis. But I,
right.
But as part of that, I'd like to quote Rupert Reed, who's a leader of the XR movement in the UK. Quote, "If people are feeling paralyzed right now, I think it is probably because they are stuck between false hopes. On the one hand, there's the delusive lure of optimism, the hope that there will be a techno fix that will defuse the climate emergency while life more or less goes on as usual. This is, I believe, a desperately dangerous way keeping us from facing up to climate reality." Unquote. That's the end of the quote. What do you think about that, and what do you think about hope and misguided hope?
Yes, I think first that techno optimism that you referred to is definitely one of the biggest, if not the biggest, sort of delusion that serves as an obstacle to understanding for many folks, especially because in point of fact, we do live in an historical time period during which there has been incredible and rapid technological development. So there is some sort of common sense reason, I think, that people believe, you know, hey, if we can fly to the moon, why can't we solve problems here on Earth or something like that? Again, people who don't have the luxury of looking deeply into these matters. And I think that's unfortunate. It's dangerous. And it also I think, serves as a kind of smokescreen that worsens the problem, because then you have folks supporting individuals like, say, Elon Musk, who want to colonize Mars, as if, you know, transplanting humans to an atmosphere-less planet is easier than potentially repairing our own, which I don't really think could be done through carbon capture or whatever anyway, technologies that don't yet exist or don't yet exist at scale. But nevertheless, that's an insane, in my view, idea that we should just place our faith in interplanetary colonization or something. So, and of course, that's just at the high end. There are many other types of the techno-optimism that you referred to, whether it's solar panels or electric cars or whatever. And so that's unfortunate. I'm not sure exactly how to counter that, other than just through education. But in general, to the point of optimism and taking hope from people, I think that that's both real and necessary, actually. So, you know, of course, there's going to be a loss of hope if you are able to get through to someone who believes in techno-optimism, technocentrism, and you sort of strip them of those beliefs, they're going to feel phenomenologically for themselves hopeless, right? They're going to have that experience of grief or whatever. But that's necessary in order to move to a position of higher understanding. And that's part of the educational process, which also goes back to Plato. The Socratic method is intended to produce precisely that effect called aporia, where Socrates sort of undermines his interlocutors' beliefs by showing to them that they don't actually have reasons to support the beliefs that they think they believe in. And this makes people pretty pissed off usually, and they tend to lash out externally rather than do the hard inward introspective internal work that needs to be done in order to create new beliefs for themselves. However, I mean, again, I think that that's absolutely necessary, and I think it moves us to a space where we can be more free to engage in activity that is the right thing to do, regardless of whether it will succeed or not. You know, there's a speech from Cornel West that I saw one time that I'll paraphrase a little bit, where he says, you know, he doesn't believe in optimism. He doesn't like optimism. He doesn't think that things always turn out right, but he believes in hope, where you're going to do something anyway, even with full knowledge that it likely will fail. You do it anyway, and that for him is hope, as opposed to optimism. And I think I agree with that.
Well, I'd say that's consistent with one of the Buddhist tenets of taking right action and not being attached to the outcome.
Yes, which is actually a principle of XR's platform.
Yeah, and so I think there's a lot of I suppose we can call it all philosophy, a lot of deep thinking from the deep past that can inform the way we live, even if the situation doesn't look all that promising. Socrates was a model with respect to his death. You know, he was arguing with Plato about dying, and Plato was saying, no, you're not in the wrong, and back and forth they went. At the age of 70 years old, he drank the hemlock, right? And but he was a believer in the system of which he was a part, and I think this is really important. He thought that the system itself, it was more important to protect the system than it was to protect his own life, because he was such a strong believer in the judicial and the entire system that he was part of. So today we have a lot of people who are not particularly impressed with the system that we are a part of. This set of living arrangements is not something we feel attached to or that we feel is just and right in many cases. So we have a little bit different situation than Socrates did with respect to our own deaths and our defense of the system. Can you comment on that a little bit, if you can figure out what the hell it is I'm trying to say?
Yes, absolutely. And I think I do understand what you're saying, because it's something I've thought about as well. So bear with me, because I do have some thoughts about this. First, I think that your interpretation is the widely accepted one about Socrates' willingness to die. But I look at it in a slightly different light, because in the Apology, for example, when Socrates, through the voice of Plato, is making his case, he describes the laws of Athens through a metaphor. He says that they're like his parents. And so for me, this changes sort of the tone of his commitment to them, because I think, although I do think that Socrates, or the Platonic Socrates, thought that Athenian laws were pretty good, and the culture was pretty good, etc., and worth dying for, I think at a deeper level, if we look at Plato's other works and we take his word that this is what Socrates believed, I think that Socrates, his commitment to Athens was rather his recognition that, just from a very bare empirical perspective, he could not have existed without them. They gave birth to him, imperfect as they are, and therefore he feels an obligation to them, similarly to how many people feel an obligation to their parents. Mm-hmm. However, I do tend to agree, I think, with the framing that you were just giving in the present day, with the idea that you know, our culture and laws, certainly during our lifetimes in the United States, have been malicious, more harmful than beneficial. And so we should not probably feel the same kind of obligation that Socrates felt. And in fact, in the Republic, Plato, I think, addresses this a little bit. I think this is now book eight of the Republic, where Plato is exploring different types of constitutions, you know, oligarchy, aristocracy, tyranny, etc. And he said, and then the corresponding individual who is likely to grow up under those constitutions. And he says that, if I'm recalling correctly, that in a democracy, it's an accident, basically, if a good person like Socrates comes into being, because there's nothing in the structure per se that should be, through design, meant to produce a Socrates. And so the Socratic person, under those sort of accidental circumstances, does not owe his or her society the same kind of debt. In other words, Socrates has come to being in spite of the constitution under which he lives. And I tend to feel that way. But it's mixed, because there are some great things, at least about the United States, that I do think have influenced me, and that perhaps only could have influenced me if I had lived here. At the same time, I certainly advocate the complete overthrow of the American government, I think, as a form of self-defense.
Right. That's quite the mixed message you're giving there.
I know. It's tough. It's tough and, to tease out.
And I'm right there with you. You know, we enjoyed this enormous privilege simply because we are of a certain race, born at a certain time in a certain place. And we didn't choose any of those. And on the other hand, we know that that privilege comes at enormous cost. And any thinking person has to know that there are costs associated with our privilege.
Yes.
And so that leaves us in the perfect place for your philosophy, this existential position of simultaneous dread and, oh my goodness, I'm so privileged I can hardly stand it.
Yes, it is a predicament, as you say, and it might be a maddening one, literally.
Yeah.
Can I return to the issue of hope just briefly once more?
Sure.
I want to give you the ultimate example of gambling everything on hope. In the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in their representative concentration pathways, they have carbon capture and storage technology factoring in, even though those pathways take us to a 6C temperature rise. Included in that is carbon capture and storage technology that does not exist.
Right.
They are hoping that somewhere along this road, they will come up with that technology, and that'll only limit the warming on the planet to 6°C, whereas 2°C is probably an extinction event for us. I just can't believe it that they gambled everything on it, and everybody, including our government here in New Zealand, everybody keeps quoting these diluted positions that are coming out of the IPCC, which are political positions. Very little of it is backed by science that includes the precautionary principle.
Yeah, I mean, that shows many things, I think, and one of them is that really people are not acting in good faith on this matter at all. You know, they're willing to use whatever lies or partial truths that they can to essentially continue business as usual, right? It's astonishing to me. And maybe some are not doing so with malicious intent, right? Maybe they are so deeply deceived themselves that they genuinely believe in the kinds of facts and figures you were just citing, or they genuinely believe that carbon capture technology will come to pass in time. But that's part of why I'm so passionate about XR and the issue of, you know, expanding climate awareness in general, is that we cannot have any realistic or meaningful collective action if we don't equally and as near universally as possible perceive the situation in which we are. So that's it's tough. It's very tough, I think, for those of us who have a deeper understanding to sort of watch the it's almost ritualistic behavior. It's sort of like we're in an anthropological position where we're observing an isolated tribe engage in some sort of, sacred ritual to produce rain, let's say. We know from a scientific perspective that it won't produce that outcome, but they believe in it and it's meaningful to them and they do it anyway. That's one way that I think about it sometimes in order to relieve my anger.
Well, I think that's right. I think that many people, perhaps most in this society, couldn't even imagine that there's a different way to live. And so if you're born into a privileged position and you're a politician, for example, or a CEO, then what follows from that? This is all you've ever known. You might be willing to defend this to the death. This system that is destroying all life on Earth, because it's the only thing you know, you don't know anything else, and therefore you assume this is the only, the best, the absolute pinnacle of how humans should live.
Can I cut in there, and as we're sort of coming to the end of the hour very shortly, there was one other subject I really wanted us to discuss while we're on here, and that is a recent presentation by Dr. James E. Henson that I sent your way, where he is spruiking for nuclear power at a time when they're having to shut nuclear power stations down in Europe in the heat waves. And I'd like you to just give a little bit of a comment about that latest presentation from Henson, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, this was posted on the Troll Farm, YouTube, on June 30th, so just a couple of days ago, that's 2019. And when asked about my 10-year prediction for extinction, Henson replied, quote, "That's crazy. You can't kill people that easily." And I might be crazy. That's not really the issue here. The issue here is the inability or unwillingness of some scientists, including apparently James Henson, the physicist and astronomer, to not understand biology and ecology. It's clear that there are many ways by which we can actually kill people that easily, a lot of them. I posted on my blog, March 20th, 2019, a short video clip called Edge of Extinction, Examples of Rapid Extinction of Animals. And I give a bunch of examples, one of which is the Bellinger River Turtle. It was saved from extinction by putting it in zoos. So the situation means they have to live in a zoo to avoid extinction. That's called functional extinction. You could argue that humans are trapped in the urban zoo, and that when we lose habitat beyond the urban zoo, we won't survive within the zoo. But a more telling example is the San Benedicto rock wren that went extinct in less than 2 weeks after losing its only habitat, which was the San Benedicto Island off the coast of Mexico. Now, this is an animal that could fly, so it could go to other islands, and no doubt did try to go to other islands where it found no habitat for the San Benedicto rock wren. Once we lose habitat for our favorite species, even our favorite species, even Homo sapiens, the self-proclaimed wise ape, when we lose habitat, it won't take long before our species disappears. And we're already losing habitat quite rapidly on the planet, as witnessed by the refugee crises afflicting the southern border of the United States, throughout Central America, the Middle East, Northern Africa, the islands in the South Pacific, and so on. So I think this is yet another example of somebody with little or no background in biology or ecology trying to nullify projections by people who actually understand the forces of extinction and habitat, for example. So I was quite disappointed, obviously, with James Hansen and his take on my work. But it doesn't surprise me. After all, here's a man who has been asked several times to appear on a stage with me, either in the form of a debate or a forum or something like that, and has declined every time. So I'm disappointed, but not terribly surprised. And if your solution is nuclear power, then apparently you learn nothing from Three Mile Island, and you learn nothing from Chernobyl, and you learn nothing from Fukushima, and it's only going to get worse on the nuclear front from here forward, because there is no reasonable way, that is no reasonable way to boil water.
Yeah. Albert Einstein said it was a stupid way to boil water way before we knew anything about climate change.
Yeah, in fact, his response when he realized the effects of nuclear power, his response was, had I known what they were going to do with it, I would have become a shoemaker. That's quite a statement for a man who is commonly viewed as among the most intelligent and accomplished people in human history.
That reminds me of Oppenheimer's comments, which you probably have seen, about the feeling after the Manhattan Project, where he quoted some Eastern philosophical text that I'm blanking on, where he says, I am become death, destroyer of worlds. And he expresses tremendous regret about his role in developing the atom bomb.
And so it has come to be. Hey, I think we'll wrap it at this point, gentlemen. Rory, thank you so much for your time today and dropping everything that you were doing and coming on board and doing so well with the New York Council.
Yes,
well,
thank
I'd like
you.
To thank AfroZen for our theme music. You can catch NBL on PRN the first Tuesday afternoon of the month at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 8 a.m. Wednesday here in New Zealand. Our next episode is live on August 6, 2019. If you missed the broadcast, you can find it in the archives at prn.fm, the Podbeam, or at Stitcher, and feel free to rate us on iTunes. You can also continue to follow the Nature Bat's last blog, guymcpherson.com, for further updates, interviews, and speaking tours. And you can keep up with my work at kevinhester.live. Until the next time, remember the dominant culture has been very clever. And in the end,
nature bats last.
Mother Nature. get you.